Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. Broadcasting from WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Every spring, just like in the song, I get a certain longing to spend April in Paris. I couldn't make that trip again this year, so I decided we'll all take a virtual trip there via this week's Louisiana Eats. First, we rendezvous with New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu at the new St. Roch Market, a place where charcuterie, crepes, and cheeses are served, much like in a Parisian marché. Then, we take off for an exploration of the cheeses of France with cheese expert Liz Thorpe. So pack your bags, we're going to Paris on this week's Louisiana Eats. One of the latest accomplishments of New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu's second term is the revival of the St. Roch Market, the last of the original city markets that once dotted New Orleans cityscape. Originally built in 1875, the building has been restored to its former glory and now houses 19 different vendors, each offering delectable food to be eaten there or fresh raw ingredients for cooking at home.
I'm Mitch, what's your name?
Carmen.
Hi, Carmen, you've been working here since it opened?
Yeah.
You like it?
Nice
to see you. How's life?
Everything
is wonderful.
A lot of
customers, it's good.
We've been so slammed.
It's great. You're the one selling carrot cake?
Yes.
All right, would you do me a favor? Is that the last slice? Would you put that in a to-go box for me?
Yeah, of course.
All right.
Zephyr.
Zephyr, yeah. So you're doing all right. Hey, you guys.
We are better than good. Not today.
Oh, it's fabulous.
Of course.
Everything's fabulous.
Can you believe how nice it is? I mean, it's unbelievable.
It's gorgeous. And the food is phenomenal.
You know Miss Bobby? You know Poppy Tooker, who's a friend of mine?
Oh, yes.
Everyone.
Yes, sir.
Urban Ritz.
Was it good?
Very good.
Cold chicken sandwich.
As opposed to a hot chicken sandwich? Like, why?
As usual, the popular gregarious mayor was stopped at virtually every table for a handshake or a photo op.
How you doing, Mitch?
Good.
Finally, we got him out of the building for a conversation on the sunny back patio.
I mean, you see that a lot where people in New Orleans, I think, and maybe this is true all over the world, but they like being with each other,
yeah,
and they like sharing things.
When we walked through, everybody was like, do you want a bite of this off my plate, Mayor? You know, where else do you go where somebody's like just offering you food off their fork, off their plate?
I should have taken that guy up and eaten this carrot cake.
That was really great.
But it's just, you know, and the other thing, too, is, you know, you notice from walking in there, people have a keen sense of where they were when they were little kids.
Yes.
So, like, a lot of times when I talk about building the city back, I said, we're not going to build it back the way it was. We're going to build it the way it always should have been. And so you can see people in the music that they play, in the food that they make, in the houses that they build. They're kind of reaching back to the history, but they're leaping forward too, and they're connecting the future and the past together, and they're creating something. They're creating a new history for the city. And that's what's so exciting about it. This building, the physicality of it, what's going on inside of it, is the best representation of a theme about building back New Orleans after Katrina, that we're not putting it back like it was. And like it was wonderful. Mr. Lama and Mrs. Lama sat back there. It was a seafood market. It was nice, right? But this, which is a more accurate renovation of what it was when it was originally done, back in 1875 and 1937, is a much, much better rendition of the past than actually what we had, because we let it dilapidate over time. History is really important. We never, ever want to forget our history. We never want to disrespect it, and we always want to remember it well. But some people have a very short memory of history. Like, for example, when the mayor of Paris was here a couple of weeks ago and I was talking to her about our 300th anniversary and speaking to her about how old we were, she said, what are you talking about? You guys are just 300 years old. I mean, where I come from, you know, we celebrate birthdays in the thousands of years. This is a pristine restoration of the way this building was in 1937 when the WPA gave us the money to reconstruct it. And so it's been stripped down to its bones. It's been put back in its original version. And now what it's producing, the economic impact and the community cohesion, is really far superior to what was here for a long period of time, even though what was here was very useful to the community. There's always a struggle in this town between how you prepare for the future and how you honor the past. But sometimes people hold on to things in our past that weren't great about who we were and what we are. And there is a way to meld the two.
Yes.
As long as you meld the soul of the two things. Because when Katrina hit us, I think one of the things that we relearned, that we were taught very early but we forgot, was that a house is not a home. The church building is not the church community. Right? The restaurant is not the physical structure, but it's the wait staff and the chefs that work in it. And unfortunately, physicality can be taken away from us at any time. But if you lose the soul, that's when you're dead. And so one of the things we always have to do is as we're kind of trying to conceptualize what we want our city to look like, what we want our spaces to look like, what's important is that the history of who we were and the real soul of it, connected from time immemorial, right, into yes. the future, is connected. Then the physical structures will follow that. It's like design and function. Steve Jobs talked a lot about this when he was designing Apple. Both of these things have to go hand in hand. They're both critically important if you want to come out with a really wonderful whole. And we think a lot about those things when we're trying to work with how we rebuild every neighborhood in the city. And of course, I don't really think that there's any better example of that vision than the St. Rock Market. It's really the one thing that I found myself most elated about in the last couple of weeks. I really have been on cloud nine because it came out exactly the way we wanted it to. And it actually was a proof point that the thoughts and ideas we had as a community can actually work if you have enough patience and time and you ask the people in the community what they want.
Well, that's what a market is supposed to be about. Whether it's a food market where you're buying food that you're going to eat on the spot, or if it's a food market where you're going to go home and cook. And as we walked through the St. Rock Market, I loved it when those two older ladies said, it's like the French Market again.
Right, exactly.
And the French Market is like the French Market again. Tell me a little bit about it.
It's getting better. Well, there are a couple of things going on. First of all, we have something called the Fresh Market Retail Initiative, where through the federal government, state funds, and city funds, we're able to kind of fill the gap in financing for folks that want to provide the access to fresh food to really difficult neighborhoods. So we're in the St. Rock Market, and we're now in the St. Rock neighborhood, which has fallen on hard times. It's beginning to come back. You can see us not just putting this market here as an isolated event, but this market is a part of rebuilding a place. So down the street from here, we're rebuilding a school, Colton. Across the street, we have a community center. Down the street, we have a recreation, because we're trying to rebuild a place. And we're trying to make sure that the government is participating with the private sector to make sure that they're targeted. And while we're doing that, as though that were not enough, we're making sure that what goes on in the buildings is reflective of who we are as a community. So in this building that we speak of now, there are 19 vendors in there now, small businesses, each one of them. They collectively are employing 96 people, and 90% of them are from the neighborhood. So this is about resilience. It's about strength. Markets are kind of popping up all over the place in neighborhoods and in parking lots on Saturdays and Sundays all over the city. There's also this huge farm-to-table movement going on where we're trying to reconnect local growers to, you know, the retail market as well. So all of this, that people are kind of finding each other. I told my team when I got here, I said, look, one of our jobs is just kind of create the space where people can do their own stuff. If the space is not created, people don't feel safe, there's no framework for it. But our job is not to row for everybody. It's just kind of to steer.
Right.
And what's interesting is that I'm not sure you could do this in every other city, but in a city where people are creative like New Orleans and people come here to create, what you find is an explosion of all kinds of crazy stuff that you never thought would happen. I was reading an article today about the Jazz Fest, which is about to occur. So we're going to about to have 500,000 people in this city. We're going to have thousands and thousands of musicians, and one of them feeds the next. And they don't take from each other. They're not competing. These musicians are giving to each other.
Oh, yeah.
And they're sharing with each other. And each product is getting different. It's kind of like that with the food industry here, too. And it's like most people in New Orleans are just sharing. So just like those ladies in there who said, hey, you want some of my, you know, cake? I'm like, no, I'll get my own. But no, you know, where else would you do that? If you were in New York, people would say, why is this strange man looking at my table?
New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu.
Liz Thorpe really knows cheese. She runs a consulting firm called The People's Cheese. Her first book was The Cheese Chronicles, and now she's hard at work on the next, a definitive guide to over 600 cheeses, complete with opinions and commentary. That makes her the perfect person to take a virtual trip through France with, to hear a cheesemonger's point of view.
I'm Liz Thorpe. I call myself a cheese ninja, but what does that mean? I have worked in the cheese business for 15 years. I own a consulting company called The People's Cheese, so I work with producers and retailers all over the U.S. and Europe. And I have written several books. I'm working on my third book right now, which will be The Definitive Guide to Cheese.
Today, I want to talk about French cheese, because I have been having this flight of fancy about April in Paris. And since I couldn't go to Paris in April this year, I decided that we could take a virtual trip. So would you take us on a virtual cheese trip through France?
I would love to. France is the country that made me fall in love with cheese. The U.S. has come very, very far, very fast. But there is no country in Europe that has the diversity of cheese that France has. Every milk type is represented, every style of cheese. If you like soft, creamy, stinky, runny things, France has them better than anyone. If you like mountain cheeses, the big hard-aged cheeses, France has got those better than anyone. So it's really, in a very small area, just tremendous diversity. And they've been making cheese for thousands of years, literally, and they make it really well. So
where would we begin our tour?
Well, I like to start my tour and my tastings with milder, fresher cheeses. You know, when I think about eating or drinking, you want to start with flavors that are a little bit softer and more subtle, and then you move into the big heavyweights that are going to really, you know, take down your palate. So I would start us in the Loire Valley. We just get in our car, you know, and tootle a little bit north of Paris. The Loire Valley is the cradle of goat cheese. And actually, the most famous goat cheeses in the world are all made there and in Poitou. And they are small format, anywhere from 1 ounce, you can pop them in your mouth like a gumdrop, to, you know, maybe 8 ounces. They usually have a beautiful edible rinds that are gray and maybe a little bit green and blue. And they're just perfect spring cheeses. Goats are just starting to make milk now. So traditionally, these are cheeses that are made from the spring through the fall, and that's it. You don't get them in the wintertime. So that's where we'd begin.
So we have the beautiful goat cheeses in the Loire River Valley. Now where are we going?
So now we're going to take a turn left. We're going to go a little bit north and a little bit west, heading for either Île-de-France or Normandy. So we're going to go to Brie country or Camembert country, if you prefer. But these are basically the white-rinded, buttery, spreadable cheeses. So, you know, Brie is a general term that refers to that style of cheese, that white edible rind. And but true French Brie de Meaux or Camembert de Normandy are fabulously complex. They have a flavor profile sort of like cooked broccoli or cooked cauliflower. They get very vegetal, very mushroomy. And that crust is like, I don't know, it smells like wet straw and grass. It's just so delicious and so rustic. And that, for me, slathered on a crusty baguette. Here in New Orleans, I like Bellegarde. That's it. Like, that's dinner with a side salad. I'm very content.
Yeah, that makes me very happy, too.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we've luxuriated in the Brie and the Camemberts. Where are we going next?
Well, I would say if we're going to do the full sort of circuit of all of the styles, we're going to jump then to my favorite cheeses, which are the stinky cheeses.
I do too. Those are my favorite.
I mean, lots of cheese actually can be kind of stinky, but I'm talking specifically about what are called washed rind cheeses, which are orange on the outside. You can always tell a washed rind. And these are typically found in Burgundy and Alsace. So we're going to turn our car around and go east. These are the monastic cheeses. So we have the monks to thank. They were very intrepid and actually made cheese as a revenue source for the monasteries traditionally, and also were the makers of wine and beer traditionally. So a lot of these cheeses are washed in alcohol, and that cultivates this certain kind of bacteria that makes a pungent but salty, meaty, beefy kind of cheese.
Demystify this for me a little bit. How do you wash a cheese? What do you mean?
You don't put it in the bathtub, right, in a shower cap or something. But you actually take brine, salt water, and you can mix in some sort of booze if you want to. And the cheese is actually either spritzed with like an atomizer, like perfume, or it's washed with a brush. Sometimes it can actually even be washed by hand, where the sort of an affineur, a cheese ager's hands can be moistened, and they sort of pat the outside of the cheese. And you get this very unique flavor profile that reminds me a lot of cured meat. So if you like salami and you like beef jerky and you like bacon, you will like these. And you like salt, you will like these cheeses. So some of my favorites, Pont l'Evêque is actually made in Normandy. It's a milder one. But if you can find Alsatian Munster, true Munster, not like the slicing Munster we know here, that would be my pick.
Sous le ciel de Paris s'envole une chanson.
When we come back from a short break, we'll continue our voyage through France with cheese ninja Liz Thorpe. Stay tuned.
Sous le ciel de Paris marche des amoureux. Leur bonheur se construit sur un air fait pour eux.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Let's continue our French sojourn with cheese expert Liz Thorpe.
Now we're going to go south.
Okay.
We're going to go down to the sheep. So the oldest recorded evidence of cheese making is from the French Pyrenees on the Spanish border. And they have been making an aged sheep's milk wheel called Osso Irati, which is from the Osso Valley in the Pyrenees. They've been making this cheese literally for 5,500 years. The same cheese made from the same milk, the same way. These sheep go up into the hills in the summer and graze at higher altitude, and their milk is turned into a large wheel that is aged, ideally, in my opinion, for 10 to 12 months. So if you've had Manchego or you've had Pecorino, those are aged sheep milk cheeses. This is better than those.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Sheep milk is very fatty, twice as fatty as cow or goat milk. So you get this like dense, firm paste. And the texture is not soft, but in your mouth, it is full of buttery, round fat. And the flavors tend to be very subtle and a little bit caramelly, a little bit sweet.
Well, we have visited with the goats and we have summered with the sheep.
Yes.
Where are the cows, Liz?
So, well, the cows are responsible for the brie types and the washed rinds usually, but the classic French cow's milk cheeses are the mountain cheeses. So for that, we go to the French-Swiss border, to the Jura or the French Comté regions, and this is where you get the big cheeses. And by big, I mean wheels that are typically 80 pounds. Cheeses like Comté, which is the number one consumed cheese in France, or Beaufort. And these are similar to Swiss Gruyere. They are always raw milk. They are made from often, always grass-fed milk, but often the summer milk of cows that go up into the mountains. And that contributes flavor that you can't engineer that. That flavor comes through the milk. You get very floral, very complex tastes to the cheese, and they're aged. So again, harder cheeses, but they melt beautifully. They have a nutty quality to them. They're elegant and just, you know, I feel like when I eat those cheeses, it's like tasting a place. You can close your eyes and imagine being like in The Sound of Music, although that was Austria, I think, but you know what
but
I mean.
Still, those hills are alive.
That's right. The clanging of cowbells.
Is there another stop?
I would say we can't miss Roquefort. So we would hop back down south and end with a blue cheese. The most famous blue cheese in the world, perhaps, is Roquefort. Maybe one of the most famous blue cheeses. It's sheep's milk blue. And it is, what's cool about it is that this cheese is actually linked to this natural cave system in southern France. And the blue mold that's in the cheese, which is added by the cheesemaker, is actually gathered from the caves. It lives naturally in the air of the caves at Combloux, and wheels spend several weeks aging in this open air, damp rock cave. And you wind up with this mushroomy, salty, fruity, lingering blue that is so amazing, and you need to have some sweet sauterne or dessert wine with it. And then that's it, you're done. You're not tasting anything else, because by that point, you're sated.
Explain to our listeners the place that cheese plays to French people. What is cheese to French?
I can't overemphasize the degree to which cheese is part of life there in a way that I hope it will one day be part of life here. You cheese is available at every meal. It's very typical that you would eat it for breakfast, that you would eat it for lunch, and that you would eat it for dinner. Cheese is always put out after dinner as just, it's just part of the meal. And what I love about the French attitude toward cheese, and which I hope we'll see more of here, is that cheese is not a rarefied, fancy, gourmet thing for the elite. Cheese is food, and actually it's the food that you ate when you couldn't afford meat. I mean, back in the day, it was peasant food. And it's, you know, I think we sometimes get a little worked up here about you have to know all about the milk and the grapes and the, you know, no, you can just enjoy it. And they also eat locally, which is amazing. So you go to a place and you eat what's grown there, what's made there, and you go 100 miles away, which is really far in France, and it's like you're in a different country.
Well, since I was really dying to go to Paris, now that we have had this trip all around France tasting cheeses, tell us about cheesemongers in Paris.
Yes.
And the appropriate way to shop with them. Tell us about that experience.
I'll tell you what not to do, because last time I was in Paris, I did it and I was totally reprimanded. So the French take their cheese really seriously. There are a lot of, you see a cheesemonger every couple of blocks in Paris. It's like a New Yorker would have a dry cleaner on every corner. It's the same thing with cheese and bread in Paris. So you don't touch the cheese.
Oh, for starters, no touching.
So like I went in and I'm like, I work in the cheese business, and I was there for a cheese conference, and I started like handling the cheese, and they were really upset and irked by this. And I tried to explain that I knew about cheese, and they just did not care that I knew about cheese.
Once
they were like, get off the cheese.
Once they'd seen you touch the cheese, they'd had enough of you, American girl. Huh?
Yeah. And I think that's like, I mean, they are truly artisans and experts, and they regard themselves as tour guides. They're there to help you discover, and they're there to help you taste, and they want to play that role, which is different from service here in the States, I think. And when Americans or non-French come in, they want to show you what they have and what they know. The other thing is that there are no laws about pasteurized milk in Europe, so taste raw milk cheeses that are young and less than 2 months old, because we can't get them here. And that's that to me, when I'm in Europe, like all I eat is the stuff I can't get here. So that's a fun thing to do as well.
When you're in Paris, do you have a must-do cheese shop?
Oh, God. You know, I really don't, because I usually Airbnb it. And so I stay in different neighborhoods based on where I can get a great place to stay. And I like just exploring my neighborhood. And I've never had a bad experience. For me, that's the fun of Paris, is that I walk around and I just poke into the local vegetable shop and the local butcher. And I don't speak French, but I love food. And I feel like that you can speak the language of food even if you don't actually speak French.
Well, thank you, Liz.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you took us on the tour.
Oh, me too. And I hope everyone goes out and treats themselves to a French cheese adventure. It's the best.
Please come back again.
Thank you. Indeed, I will. I'd love to.
Liz Thorpe, author, Cheese Authority, and our Louisiana Eats Cheese Ninja. The John Besh Foundation recently hosted their first ever Fête de Chef fundraiser. John Besh's celebrity chef buddies came from all over the country, each cooking an intimate dinner in private homes across the city. The pastry chefs wanted to participate too, so the evening concluded with a dessert party extravaganza. Our roving reporter Nate Winter was there, and he sent us this postcard from the fabulous after party.
I'm Nate Winter, aka the NOLA Pie Guy and an occasional rambling reporter for Louisiana Eats. Recently, I was lucky enough to stage, or shadow, under Valrhona's corporate pastry chef, Zara Kalsakowski. Valrhona is a French chocolate company. That means they make chocolate and chocolate products, mainly for industry professionals, so pastry chefs, chocolatiers, etc. Sarah joined us recently in New Orleans from her headquarters in Brooklyn for the first ever Fête de Chef. This was a benefit fundraiser for the John Besh Foundation. Afterwards, John Besh, all his visiting chefs, all the guests joined about 200 additional guests at the Bourne restaurant at the Hyatt New Orleans. There, John's executive pastry chef, Kelly Fields, was hosting this grand dessert finale. Kelly invited 9 of the country's most talented pastry chefs to join her for this buffet-style event. There was an open bar, classic New Orleans-style live music, and more pastries than even I knew what to do with. But before that, I got to spend a day working with Sarah in the kitchen, helping her prepare her bonbons and chocolate pastries and pétiffors for the night's event.
So this is a great event for us as well because we love coming out to New Orleans, and the Besh Group and Kelly especially know how to throw a party. And when we started speaking with her about this party, it was her dream list of pastry chefs. So this is kind of not only a chef's dream, but a pastry chef's dream. And then it's a guest's dream because it's all these desserts created by some of the best pastry chefs in the country. So what we decided to do is to kind of let all the guest chefs that were coming create what they wanted to create. And that we were going to do kind of an over-the-top, huge buffet. So we tried to make it a New Orleans themed because we, again, you know, we're in New York, so it's fun for us to come down here because then we can do something that's something that we would never do before. So we did a bananas Foster truffle, beignet and chicory coffee truffle. So we really were able to push the envelope with it and have fun.
And I get the opportunity to be selfish and exploit my friendships with amazingly talented people that have these beautiful international connections. So I trained under classically trained French pastry chefs at the French Pastry School in Chicago. And when I went to school, I kind of knew going in my favorite thing was chocolate. So when Kelly's going over this list and listing all the pastry chefs, go, can I please, pretty please, like, kind of not twisting her arm, but begging and kind of nudging, like, hey, I would really like it if I could work under Sarah for Valrhona and see kind of what they do there, because we've met before in social settings down here, but never in a setting where I actually kind of got to get elbow deep in chocolate and play around and make some stuff. So it was a really fun opportunity for me to get in on that more professional level.
Well, we were very flattered and very lucky to have him helping us. And it's flattering, and it's great to know that people are interested and into the chocolate and into learning, because, I mean, that's what I do. Like, I happen to work for a chocolate company, but I never see myself as a salesperson or, you know, I just educate people on how to use the product better. And in turn, it makes all of their pastries better, and at least trying to share knowledge with people. And Valrhona's really great when we do classes about answering the why. We don't just say, because we said so, or because that's the way you do it. There is a reason why. And that's what I always appreciated when I was learning from the Valrhona chefs, because they have the answers. So I don't have all the answers yet, but I'm getting there. And I mean, that's a great part too. It's like, we're constantly learning. Even though we teach, we still learn. So it's an amazing position. And when we get to do events like this, it's fantastic because we get to share the knowledge, we get to inspire other people, and the chefs here are inspiring us.
Turns out, Sarah and I have a couple things in common. One of them is Chicago. During my first trip back to Chicago after finishing the French pastry school, I had the opportunity to meet pastry chef Pierre Hermé, who's a world-renowned, classically trained French pastry chef. While Sarah and I were in the kitchen preparing a macaron filling for the dessert after-party, I discovered that Sarah too has a connection to Pierre Hermé. It's a story about an ingredient you might not expect.
So Pierre Hermé is huge in France, and he has now several pastry shops worldwide, but he's best known for his shops in Paris. And one thing that he makes that everyone always raved about was this vanilla tart. And for me, I was kind of like, it's a vanilla tart. What is so great about this? Like, I'm going to try this or that before I try a vanilla tart. So I ended up being with some friends at the pastry shop, and I had the pleasure of enjoying the vanilla tart. Life-changing. He uses, actually, Valrhona chocolate, our white chocolate, to create this ganache with three different types of vanilla bean. And there's so much vanilla that it actually alters the color of the white chocolate and almost turns it gray because there's so many vanilla seeds in it. And it's like no other vanilla you've ever had because it's so pure and so rich and fragrant and floral. And when I came back to the U.S., I was like, I need to find this recipe or figure out what he did with it. And come to find out, it's literally white chocolate, cream, and vanilla, but it's all about the vanilla. So I took that and we altered it slightly. We were doing a brandy milk punch macaroon, keeping with the New Orleans theme. So of course there had to be some brandy and some nutmeg in there. So we pulled back on the vanilla and then adjusted the flavors. But it still has that great texture and just very simple ingredients. But because you're using very good, pure ingredients, the flavor is just outstanding.
After 36 hours of working to prepare for the grand finale of Fête de Chef, Sarah and I were almost ready to unveil the chocolate buffet. Here, Sarah describes her creations for our Louisiana Eats listeners.
So basically, we have 14 different jars in all different shapes and sizes. We're trying to make it look like a very elaborate candy store, but a candy store gone a little bit awry. So there's going to be giant blocks of chocolate that are chopped up, fèves, which are what we call our little pieces of chocolate. There it's bean in French. And it's just kind of going to be this really fun display with all these different size glass jars filled with everything from the bonbons that we made to the cookies. One of the other chefs, I'm looking at these huge bins right now of popcorn, is going to put literally 10 pounds of popcorn all over her table. So it's kind of this, you know, chaos, but contained and very, very precise chaos, because the desserts are super clean and very, very thoughtful. But then there's going to be chocolate on the table and popcorn on the table. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
The final step, putting it all together. Sarah directed me as we assembled her candy store gone awry and revealed a few last minute surprises.
So the two macaroons will go on that.
Okay.
And then the Alanka bonbon will go on one of those as well.
I love that you have hurricane pâte de fouille.
There's not real rum in it. There's some rum extract.
It's like what we can get.
But it tastes like a hurricane, I believe.
So exciting.
Super sweet and passion fruity syrupy. So, and then I basically made donuts and then turned them into white chocolate ganache. So it tastes like a donut. And then they're covered in powdered sugar, so, because beignets are covered in powdered sugar, right?
Before joining the after party, I got the chance to sit down and listen as Chef Kelly convened her team of chefs and volunteers, giving them their final marching orders for the evening.
Y'all that don't normally work for me, the understanding is that you are a representation of John Bash and myself tonight. And our pride and our mission is to be hospitable aggressively. So if anybody needs anything, make it happen. Have fun. No drinking until I say it's time. Cool?
Yes, Chef.
Thank you, Chef.
I slept for like 30 minutes. I feel like a new person.
Once the guests started to arrive, we got our second win, and the party was a perfect reward for an exhausting but inspiring weekend.
So much sleep I've gotten in 2 days. It's awesome.
I'm Nate Winner for Louisiana Eats.
What makes blue cheese blue? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
Chatterton, suicidé.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What makes blue cheese blue? That blue color comes from the mold Penicillium. It's said to have been discovered accidentally when the mold naturally found in caves infected the cheeses left there to age. Today, most cheesemakers use manufactured Penicillium, which they inject in the cheese to cause the reaction which produces blue cheese. That's why sometimes you'll see straight lines in a blue cheese. Those are actually needle marks. The reason it's safe to eat this kind of moldy food is that blue cheese has the perfect combination of acidity, salinity, moisture, and density, which prevents the mold from becoming toxic. It's Brevibacterium linens that make blue cheese smell, well, kind of stinky, which is just the thing so many cheese lovers love. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. If you shop the French market, you may notice a surprising lack of traditional French food. But you'll change your tune when you come upon a crepe cart that looks like it belongs on the Champs-Élysées. That cart belongs to Tracy Kish and Samantha Salater. They took a break from feeding the hungry masses to tell us about their magical cart.
Hi, I'm Samantha.
And I'm Tracy.
And we're the co-owners of the crepe cart at the French Market.
We make crepes in the traditional French style from push cart that we designed with the fun of the city in mind.
We tried to make it like old world style with big wagon wheels and kind of a European paint job because we wanted to bring back some of the authentic street food vibe to the city.
We met while we were working at the late shift at a high profile creperie. So we perfected our art in crepe making over the years, and we realized that it would be brilliant to have a cart because that's how they were originally served.
It was like really high volume, so there's like a lot of demand to get as fast and efficient as possible at making crepes. And then we also did catering where we had to pull out a lot of tents and tables, and so we wanted to kind of streamline the process. We also went to a Renaissance fair and saw a pickle cart, and we were like, we could do crepes out of a cart.
We have grill plates that we imported from France because if you're going to do crepes, you have to get a real crepe grill from Europe. So you take the batter and you pour it in the center of the grill plate, and you use a wooden paddle kind of thing to spread it in a circle as thin as you can, and then you'll fold it and flip it to make it into a triangle.
We try to have something for everybody. So we make sweet and savory and vegan and gluten-free crepes. Some of the most popular savory ones are the SBT, which is spinach, bacon, and tomato, or our Caprese, which is tomato, basil, and mozzarella. The most popular sweet is probably banana Nutella.
One of the things that we're really proud of in the market is a lot of the things that are served here already are the classic, like oysters, crawfish, you've got alligator on a stick, and popcorn shrimp. And that's pretty much all you see. There's a lovely lady over here who sells like cakes and cookies, but there's not a lot in the way of something more simple. And that's something that the French market is trying to change, is they brought in like a sandwich shop over there that has like great cheeses and stuff. And there's Meals from the Heart, which is healthier. But everyone really appreciates that we have a more affordable and more simple thing. Like you can get a caprese, which is just tomatoes and mozzarella. It's more of a simple, like healthier snack option.
We're not so Cajun-centric.
Yeah, we're not spicy. A lot of people are like, I can't eat anything here because it's all seafood and spicy, and we offer the alternative there. Also, a lot of American people are a little confused about crepes because a lot of people learn about crepes from places like IHOP, but the way we do it is they're like a nice golden brown, and they hold up to themselves. So you can walk around with one and just kind of nibble on it as you go, like you would, I don't know, a burrito. One of my proudest moments was we had an older couple come up and they ordered a crepe Suzette. And that's like the most traditional crepe there is. And they told us, while we were making it, they told us that they owned a creperie in France.
Oh, wow.
And so the pressure was on and we were really nervous about it. And they ate, I think they got a caprese too, actually. And they ate, and they came back, and they said that was great.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yes, we passed the French test.
The true test, yeah.
Tracy Kish and Samantha Salater at their French Market Crepe Cart. Brian Berkey is one of the most well-schooled wine authorities in the U.S. Designated a certified wine scholar from the French Wine Society, he holds the title of master in the wines of Provence, Burgundy, and the Rhone. A recognized sommelier by the court of the Master Sommelier, Brian received both a diploma and advanced certificate from the Society of Wine Educators Trust. Welcome to Louisiana Eats, Brian.
Oh, thank you, Poppy.
What is Champagne?
Well, Champagne with a large C is a wine-growing region in the country of France. And Champagne with a small C is a bubbly beverage that we love to drink.
Where do the bubbles come from?
This is what's really fascinating about Champagne and sparkling wines really from all over the world. The wine starts as still wine, just like regular wine that you'd buy in the store and pull the cork on and pour. Now, what happens is that wine gets blended and put into the bottle that you pour your champagne from. Yeast and sugar is added. A bottle cap is put on. That wine is then stored. And this is where champagne really differentiates itself from the rest of the world. It's stored anywhere from 3 years upwards. You can get them that have been stored for 12, 20 years. And then that cap comes off. The yeast is removed, and then that mushroom cork that we're so used to with its cage is put on. And that process creates the bubbles.
Is all champagne the same?
Champagne has three major categories that we look at. One, of course, is your standard mix of Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier. Those are the three grapes that are authorized for use in Champagne. And of course, they end up being the wine grapes that we use to make sparkling wines around the world, emulating Champagne. But there, they must use those. So a blended wine is one type. Another one would be to not blend. One would be a Blanc de Blanc, which is white wine from white grapes, 100% Chardonnay. Another would be a Blanc de Noir, which would be white wine, the Blanc, from black grapes, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier. Now, of course, you've also got rosé. That's your third style. And then you get into real subtleties, and that is non-vintage versus vintage. But those are our major categories of champagne.
What's the difference between vintage and non-vintage?
So remember I was saying we took still wine and we put it in that bottle? So, of course, obviously we're talking about three different grapes, so we blend three different still wines. Well, we actually blend also different years. And the reason for that is so that when you go buy a bottle of champagne, it has a more consistent flavor than, the vintage is the year on the bottle, and that can vary depending on the weather you had from 1 year to another. Very rainy, very dry, very hot, very cold. These will make different flavors in your wine. Well, by blending multiple years of wines, you can even out some of those variances. So when you go buy your bottle of Veuve Clicquot 1 year, next Christmas you buy another bottle, they taste very similar.
Why is champagne considered the most celebratory of all wines?
I think it starts with the pop, of course. You know, it makes its own entrance into the world.
That happy sound.
Beautiful, beautiful sound. And then the bubbles themselves bringing up the aromas. You know, they're not kind of sort of sitting in the glass. They're splashing up at you. It's very vivacious. It's also expensive. So, you know, when you're spending a lot of money, you want to make sure you're having a really good time. So,
what foods do you think go well with champagne?
It's really what foods don't go well with champagne. I mean, champagne is really the one wine that goes well with everything or is beautiful by itself. It's the most versatile wine. You can drink champagne with very spicy food. It helps to calm down that spice. You can eat it with very greasy food. It's got the nice, bright acidity and the bubbles. They help clean the palate and make the next bite really fresh and inviting. So there's really nothing you can't eat. You would be amazed, especially now, I think I make that statement, but again, remember there were all these different categories of champagne. So different champagnes do go better with some food. So, a nice ripe vintage champagne can go all the way up to meat dishes.
So now we know that champagne only comes from that one region in France, and the rest is really considered just sparkling wine. So what do you think about the sparkling wines of the United States?
The sparkling wines of the United States, generally, we're talking about California. But they are being made quite well in Michigan. There's even some people making them, there happen to be two French gentlemen, making them in New Mexico. A very little bit up in North New York, some in Oregon. So it's around, but it dominate from California. And the quality is just really, you know, I want to like to mention that. The quality of champagne is not one thing. It's not monolithic. You know, there's fabulous, unbelievable champagne, and there's really, you know, just okay champagne. And the same thing with American bubbles. There's unbelievably good, and there's really just kind of okay. So you need to have some experience and try a lot of different ones. That's the best way to learn, is by trying.
That's a hard job, but it sounds like a really fun one. Brian, thanks for giving us the lowdown on what makes the bubbly so bubbly.
Oh, thank you. I love being here.
Talking with Brian about my favorite bubbly just made me want to sing. Luckily, Chanteuse Jenny Merrill did the singing for me. Here's Jenny with our drinkable musical interlude from the Southern Food and Beverage Museum.
The night they invented champagne, it's plain as it can be, they thought of you and me. The night they invented champagne, they absolutely knew that all we'd want to do is fly to the sky on champagne and shout to everyone inside that since the world began, no woman or a man has ever been as happy as we are tonight.
Yeah. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Bacardi USA and Dickie Brennan and Company. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Chris Kehoe, Joe Schreiner, and Sarah Holtz.
Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.